This is the second edition, revised, expanded edition of Beyond the Cosmos. And hey, it's in paper, so we can reduce the price. So I meant to bring a dozen with me this morning, but I left them at home. I got two, so but we'll have some here next week. So all right, where we left off last time, we were talking about the Vela supernova and the shortening of human lifespans. Those of you that are new or missed last week, let me set the context by reading Genesis 6, verses 1 through 4. When men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful and they married any of them they chose. We'll be getting into that subject next. Then the Lord said, My spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, the men of renown. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. And the Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. Okay, we'll stop there. And what this text is pointing out in the third verse is that God acts to shorten human lifespans down to a maximum 120 years. And if you were with us last week, let me get my notes so I know where we left off last week. Here we go. we discussed, yes. Well, the last time we kind of put that in context with God shortening human lifespans. What we discussed last time was the latest scientific evidence for a severe radiation-enhancing event that would significantly shorten human lifespans and the dates that astronomers can now put on that event. What I'd like to discuss today are ways that we can experimentally test that conclusion, that this indeed was God's tool for shortening human lifespans, and then to deal with the charge that I've often heard when I've been speaking on this on university campuses, saying, well, your Christian God is just simply reacting to natural disasters and making the theology fit. So we're going to try to demonstrate from Scripture that that proposition is not true, that the theology was in place first and the so-called natural event followed afterwards. So those are the two themes we're going to cover. Yes?
I don't know if you've discussed this, but I've always thought that 120 years was the amount of time until the flood that he gave in that period of grace, which is one interpretation. Have you talked about how it really means the length of life?
Well, okay, you've got approximately 100 years. The text says about 100 years. I mean, when Noah was 500 is when he began to build the ark, when he was 600 and the rain started to come down. But the text doesn't say exactly 100 years, but it's reasonably close, probably 100 plus or minus 1 is what we're talking about. So it makes it difficult to fit 120 into that unless you're going to claim that Noah got this message 20 years earlier before he was actually told to build the ark. You know, that's a little harder to support scripturally. And what it does say is that he will not live. I mean, the Lord said, My spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. So it seems like it's saying this is something generic to all human beings rather than just to those people alive at the time. Nevertheless, you cannot explicitly prove it. I'm giving you an implicit deduction from the text, but it's one that seems to fit in with the larger context. So in terms of the Bible commentaries in Genesis, I don't know of any that are claiming that this is not referring to the shortening of human lifespans. So, but yeah, just to pick up where we left off last time, I gave you three dates, actually four dates, for the eruption of the Vela supernova, the first date being from Robert Breckinridge, 8,400 to 12,000 years ago, 14,500 years ago. But as we mentioned, that date is no longer held in esteem because he failed to correct for the proper motion of the star responsible for the supernova eruption. Again, for those of you that weren't here last week, the claim that we're making is that in terms of causes for shortening human lifespan, I could just show you this again quickly. No, wrong one. Here we go. Significant factors for extending human lifespan are as follows, but the one that's impossible to get around and is the most significant for preventing us from living past 120 years are these last two. And so in terms of trying to find some kind of cause for the shortening human lifespan, you really either look at the reprogramming of cell death in the human body, or you look at an increase in radiation. Now, radiation comes from two sources, cosmic rays and decay of the Earth's radioactive materials in the Earth's crust. We know there's been no change in the decay of radioactive elements in the Earth's crust. That's something we could measure quite accurately with respect to time. That leaves you with cosmic rays. So that's why we're fingering cosmic rays as the reason why we can't live past 120 years, and we're claiming that it's both. The suggestion I'm making is that right here in Genesis 6:3, God reprogrammed our cells so that we can't live past 120 years, which actually protects us from earlier deaths by cancer and other causes that would be generated by the radiation that we're now experiencing. And indeed, astronomers have been able to pinpoint a single event in human history that greatly enhanced our cosmic ray exposure, that being the Vela supernova. There are many supernova. Cosmic rays, 99% of them come from supernova explosions. But the paper I referred to by a couple of Russian astronomers, I have it right here. Let me pull it out. Here it is. This particular paper makes the point that the vast majority of cosmic rays that would work to shorten the lifespans of advanced mammals comes from a single event, Vela, which exploded a certain time ago, 1,300 light years away. It's the only significant supernova event that's that close to us in space and in time. As far as the date goes, a British study looking at the spin down of the pulsar left over from the supernova eruption calculates as 22 to 29,000 years ago. Two independent German studies looking at the movement of the star, the pulsar, with respect to the distant background stars, corrected the studies by Robert Breckenridge. Robert was the one, if you recall, who looked at the ejecta flowing out from the star and then looked at the velocity of the ejecta and how far it got and calculated a date, but he forgot to correct for the proper motion. Two groups of Germans have done that. The dates they get are 18,000 plus or minus 9,000 years ago and 31,000 plus or minus 6,000 years ago. So if you take the British date, the two German dates, you get something between 20 and 30,000 years ago. Now, you might say, that's not very satisfying. It really isn't, but all three of these research teams indicated that these were preliminary analyses. Given a few more years, they should be able to produce a much more precise date. I would think within 5 to 10 years, we're probably looking at a date for the eruption of the Vela supernova that'll be accurate to at least 1,000 years. And this may prove to be our best means for calculating the time of Noah's flood. There's no other method I can think of that could help us date Noah's flood besides that. However, one of the things that would be nice to do is to really test experimentally whether cosmic rays really have this kind of damaging effect on shortening lifespans. Okay, and there's a few ways we could proceed with this. Let me discuss the most brutal method. Okay, the most brutal method would be to take a family of human volunteers and have them live in a habitat where you have, say, three times the cosmic rays being zapped at them that we experience, and see what happens to them and their children, their grandchildren, and their great-grandchildren. Now, I don't think that's going to ethically fly with any research group, so, and it takes too long. I mean, you got to wait several hundred years before you got any decent research results. Pardon me? Would you get grandchildren? That'd be one of the things you could test, all right? And what are they going to be like? So that experiment is obviously not going to be performed. Yes? Okay, what arrives first, the light or the cosmic rays? Cosmic rays begin to arrive virtually as soon as the light arrives. Okay, but the light of the supernova eruption, supernova do pour out a lot of radiation in visible light, but it disappears quickly. Within 7 months, the eruption is over in terms of visible radiation. Radio radiation will extend for tens of thousands of years thereafter. Likewise, cosmic radiation. So with the beginning of the eruption, you have the beginning of the flow of cosmic radiation. Excuse me. Now, what's interesting, in terms of what you see in Genesis chapter 11, is that the way astronomers analyze a supernova is that the cosmic radiation should increase after the eruption, because what's happening is the cosmic rays are coming from the remnants of the supernova eruption. So as these remnants develop and grow, the cosmic radiation will gradually increase, and then it will go away. But you've got thousands of years in which this cosmic radiation is quite intense. So the radiation we're getting from Vela today is roughly comparable to the radiation that human beings would have received a couple of thousand years after the Vela supernova eruption. But yeah, if you wait a couple of hundred thousand years, it will dissipate considerably. But we're now in that window of time when it's quite intense. Now, the fact that it takes some time to build up may explain what we see in Genesis chapter 11. Because what you notice there is Noah lives for 350 years after the flood. He makes it to a ripe old age of 950. His son Shem, he doesn't die until he's, 500 years old. And what you see is an exponential decline in human lifespans from Noah, 950, or Shem of 500, down to about 148 years, which I believe was Nahor who made it that far, 148. Let me see what I got here. Yes, Noah, 950, Nahor, 148. Then it gets down to the fact that nobody makes it past 120. So, you know, Moses is a good example of somebody who made it to the maximum. All right? So, yes.
So that's
part of the curse? Well, I'd like to deal with that theological point a little bit later, because that I think is a mistake a lot of people brought into this text, saying that this is a curse God brought upon humanity. Rather, I'd like to argue that the curse is getting long lifespans. Okay, we human beings think the longer we live, the better. What we see from the Bible is it's not a good idea to live a long time. And if you want an example of what it's like to live a long time, the flood is a good example. People were living 900 years. Look what happened to them. Okay, hang tight with us a little bit. We're going to get into some of the reasons why long lifespans are not good for human beings and why we're far better off dying at age 70, 80, or 90 than making it all the way to 800 or 900 years. Okay? Now, that theological perspective will change. But wait, we'll discuss that in a few minutes. Yes.
Earlier you say that
Well, not so much we, but they would claim that, hey, your God of the Bible is simply reacting to natural catastrophes. He's not able to control a Vela supernova. So when the Vela supernova erupted, he said, well, you know, he kind of built in a theological excuse for that. So... Yeah, since it's 1,300 light years away, it erupted 1,300 years before the flood. Yes. So that's a good way to partly refute that charge that God is simply a reactive being rather than a proactive being. Okay? But we'll get into that proactivity again in a few minutes. Yes. Do you want a minute? Because I got another question back here. Oh, you remember now. No. There are no written accounts of the appearance of the Vela supernova. Not too surprising because written records don't go back that far. I mean, writing hadn't been invented yet. So we shouldn't expect that this will show up in any of the historical records. Yeah, Vela is in one of the southern constellations. So you have human beings have not yet made it to Australia or the southern tip of South America. They're not going to be seeing this thing. But boy, if anybody was there to see it, they couldn't miss it. It would have been brighter than a full moon. So easily visible in the daytime. Yes. Yeah, that's what we're going to do. Let me pick up this other overhead here, if I can find it. But, yeah, I'm not able to find it quickly. But, yeah, I mean, we have eight different causes for the shortening of human lifespan. These two make it impossible to live past 120. The rest of these can greatly shorten your lifespan. So, yeah, if you're growing up in medieval Europe, where wars are going on all the time, and you've got the Black Plague running rampant, then you might have life expectancies of only 40. Or if you're living in Russia today and you're a man, your life expectancy is 58 years. So even on planet Earth today, we have much shorter life expectancies than what we're used to here in America. And what's causing life expectancies to be so brief in Russia for the males? Bad diet, and too much cheap vodka. So that's what's really bringing the lifespan down. So, yeah, a bunch of American vodka distillers tried to go into Russia, and they bombed because they couldn't produce it cheap enough. So... Sure could. Yep. And well, we got more to share with you on that too. But again, yes.
In the literature of other cultures, that people not only lived a long time, but they were giants. They, you know, in the literature, in our own human races, they seem to be getting larger. I mean, the first generation because of better diet and so forth. Are these ancient people giants, or are they?
Okay, you're need to come back next week. We'll be getting into that maybe by the end of today. We'll see how far we get. But you're right. Human beings, they are taller than what they used to be 1,000 years ago. On the other hand, if you were to go back to Roman times, you'll discover that people living in Switzerland had an average height of 7 feet. Okay? Whereas the Romans had an average height of 5 feet. And so when the Roman soldiers came into Switzerland, the Swiss said, boy, we're going to have an easy time with these Romans. Okay? They had 70,000 soldiers, all 7 feet tall. And they were facing, 4 legions of the Roman army. And they said, this is going to be easy. The Romans won. Why? Because they had engineers. So, good plug for engineers. So, but yeah, there was a time when people were tall as we are. But what we're going to talk about is that there's a penalty for being tall. Okay? The taller you get, the more infirmities you begin to build in. There's a penalty for being too short, but there's a penalty for being too tall as well. And this will factor into our study of what these sons of God and Nephilim are all about. All right. Do we have a figure for how long it is from Adam to Noah? Well, very roughly, okay? We've been giving you dates for the birth of Adam. Mitochondrial DNA, 50,000 years ago. Y chromosome, 37 to 49,000 years ago. Most ancient art, advanced art, 32,000 years ago. So you look at biblical genealogies, 10 to 60,000 years ago. Average them all up. Something in the neighborhood of, say, 30 to 40,000 seems reasonable. Okay, we got the Vela supernova exploding between 20,000 and 30,000 years ago. Subtract one approximate number from the other approximate number, and you get an even more approximate number, all right? So something in the neighborhood of 10 to 20,000 years, maybe 5 to 20,000, be more conservative, between Adam and Noah, roughly that range of dates. So yeah, shortly after human species got going for a few thousand years, we had the Vela supernova eruption. And so during those few thousand years, people could live a lot longer. That's what we're talking about. Okay, now back to, yeah. Okay, what you see in Genesis 11 is an exponential decline in human lifespan from about 500 years down to 120 years. And that takes place over probably many hundreds or a few thousands of years. By the time you get to Abraham, you know, it's down around 120, although Abraham made it to, what, 175. Well, we don't know. There hasn't been another supernova close enough that we can run an actual test on what happens with the cosmic rays. The other problem is every supernova is a little different. Astronomers have been using supernova standard candles, but that's what's called a type 1A supernova. The rest of the supernova come in all different sizes. The bigger the supernova, the bigger the eruption, the more energy, the more cosmic rays. What we know about Vela is it was near the top of the pile. Really big, lots of radiation. So, and by the way, the reason why type 1As work is that it's a star that's not big enough to be a supernova, but it receives material from a star orbiting around it. And when it gets to that supernova minimum size, then it erupts. Which means all type 1A supernova are the same size, same kind of explosion. That's why you can use it as a standard candle. But most supernova don't fall into that category. In that case, the bigger the star, the bigger the eruption. So we were discussing last time, well, gee, how come this supernova wasn't even visible in the sky? It erupted, 800 years ago. What's going on here? That's because they all come in different types and different sizes. The one exception being these type 1As, where they're all the same. So that's how they're figuring out how fast the universe expands, whether or not there's a cosmological constant. using the standard candle supernova. But Vela's not in that category. It was a real big supernova. Okay, back to testing this. As I said, you know, the simplest way to do this is raise several generations of human beings in a radiation environment that's a lot worse than what we're facing now. No one's going to do that. We could do that with animals. Amazingly, no one has done it. It's been done with fruit flies. But fruit flies are not a very good human analogy. What you really like to do is pick something like chimpanzees and gorillas, raise them in a radiation-enhanced environment, and see what happens. But as far as I know, and maybe some of the biologists in the class can help me out here, I've seen nothing in the literature about that kind of experiment being done. And, yeah, I mean, some might have ethical inhibitions about even doing that kind of experiment. One thing to blast fruit flies with radiation, do you really want to blast some cute little chimp with radiation and the chimp's descendants with radiation? So that hasn't been done. On the other hand, we do have a couple of experiments that have been done by accident. Okay, one I can think of is Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's where human beings and advanced animals were exposed to a radiation-enhancing event. It's not as useful as we would like because an atomic bomb eruption is not an exact analogy to a supernova eruption. You get different kinds of radiation. On the other hand, it's quite obvious that it's deleterious. The radiation is deleterious. Even those people around Hiroshima and Nagasaki that weren't damaged by the heat or the blast of the eruption, the radiation nevertheless brought about a huge increase in mutations. Their lifespans were shortened, and problems were passed on to their descendants. So in that sense, we do have some kind of a test of what a radiation-enhancing event like the Vela supernova could do. The other one you can think of would be the Chernobyl accident. And again, you can see how the damage that that kind of radiation would do. But that's fission radiation with a supernova. You're looking at diffusion and fission and a completely different kind of radiation coming out. All right. The other thing you can do, and this is ethically acceptable, is to say, well, why don't we raise advanced animals or human beings in a radiation-protected environment? You know, surely people will sign up for that. It's hard to get somebody to sign up for a radiation-enhanced experiment. You know, would you like to live in this little tomb here for a few decades where you're going to be blasted with cosmic rays? Who's going to sign up for that? All right, no one. But you might be encouraged to sign up. Well, you know, instead of you being blasted with cosmic rays like the rest of your relatives, how would we protect you from them almost entirely and just see how long you live and how well you do? You might get volunteers for that. Maybe not, because what you have to do to protect the human being from the radiation is rather extreme. There's only one experiment I know of which would adequately serve the purpose, and that would be to raise human beings for several generations in some kind of deep underground thick salt deposit. And you say, why do you want to do that? Well, you don't want them to go into a coal mine. As I mentioned last week, you've got two forms of radiation that shorten our lifespan, cosmic radiation and radiation from decay of radiometric elements in the Earth's crust, which is why coal miners don't live as long as the rest of us, because they go down into that coal mine shaft, say 5,000 feet underground. They get exposed to a lot of this radiation from decay of radiometric elements, especially with coal. I mean, it is interesting, we've got this debate running around today that is environmentally more attractive to burn coal or to use uranium fission. From a physicist's perspective, you get less radiation release with a fission reactor than you do by burning coal. And yet, isn't it interesting that environmentally, coal is okay, but a nuclear reactor is not? And yet, a nuclear reactor actually releases less radiation than the burning of coal. So, if you burn coal every day in your fireplace, you do expose yourself to a lot more radiation. Yes.
Well, on the fission and
Yes. Well, yeah, radiation is helpful for treating cancer because what are you doing? You're killing the tissue with radiation. So you're using something harmful to destroy something harmful. So, yeah, you could use the equivalent of cosmic radiation to do the same thing. Hasn't been done because the equipment's far more expensive to build. It's cheaper to just get a piece of radioactive cobalt and focus the beam and do it that way. But it is kind of a brute force way of taking care of cancer. Well, keep in mind that this apoptosis is programmed cell death, and many cancers are made prolific when that programmed cell death shuts down. That means the cells can now reproduce without being checked. And so since the programmed cell death isn't stopping them from reproducing, you got to invade with something else, either chemicals or radiation. And these days we're trying to figure out which works best. What we'd really like to do is build a smart bomb. You know, you want some kind of radiation that only kills cancer and doesn't kill the healthy stuff, or some kind of chemical that does the same thing. There's been some success there, but we got a long ways to go before we have a smart cancer bomb. Yeah.
I don't want to make this straight, but
Well, you're bringing up a very interesting point, Greg, that this programmed cell death could be exploited as an argument against natural evolution. Because, you know, how are you going to get, in a space of a short time, short being 1,000 years, human apoptosis to go from 1,000 years down to 120, if all you're doing is appealing to natural selection mutations? I don't know how you're going to pull it off. And, you know, it's a little bit coincidental that it's timed with this Bella supernova eruption. The evolutionist is forced to argue, well, now the human body is exposed to all this radiation, and therefore evolution is going to kick in and move the human species towards a programmed cell death that will best fit the environment. That could work if the human species had 1 trillion individuals. And it could work if we're talking evolving the human species over 500 million years. But we're talking just millions of individuals or less adapting in just 1,000 years. A natural process isn't going to do it. So that's a good argument. Yes. Well, that's, yeah. They're just saying, well, this is a fairy tale. People really didn't live 1,000 years. We've always lived only a maximum of 120. But as we've pointed out, the Bible is not alone in making the claim that the first generations of human beings lived 1,000 years apiece, approximately. The earliest historical records of the Sumerians and the Akkadians also make the same claim. So you've got the three most ancient comments on the early origins of humanity all claim lifespans a factor of 10 longer than what we're capable of today. Gentleman in the back? Yeah, go ahead. You have to speak up. I can't quite hear. That you can do what to yourself to make yourself live longer? Huh? Freeze yourself. All right. Well, I'm from Canada. I can tell you it doesn't work. No, I mean, I'm making a joke, but what the young man is speaking about is, you know, what about this cryogenic, where you take a living human being, lower their body temperature way down, and can't you make them live longer that way? Well, a lot of people have been thinking that that's possible, but again, it's one of these experiments where it's hard to find volunteers. So, because what you'd have to do in order to guarantee that the human being wouldn't die would be to cool them down to a little bit above freezing. If you go down to freezing or below freezing, the human tissues begin to break down. Now, it has been done with more primitive life forms, and they've been able to bring them back to life. But the human tissue is not able to be brought down below the freezing point of water without the tissue being destroyed. But one thing that's been discussed as well, instead of going for 30 degrees Fahrenheit, why don't we just lower it down to 40, keep it there for a while and see what happens. And, you know, that may do something for you. Well, by the way, all you're really gaining by cryogenics, whether you go down to 40 degrees Fahrenheit or down to 10 degrees below zero, is staving off the inevitable. Because at 40 degrees Fahrenheit, if your body was successfully cooled down to 40 degrees Fahrenheit, you are totally immobile. You're not doing anything. You're in a state of suspended animation. And what's the benefit of that? When you wake up, you still only live your allotted time. Say you had the potential to live 90 years. Well, you could choose to live 40 years in the last century and 50 years in the 21st century. But you only get a total of the 90 at best, if the experiment works. And by the way, it's difficult to keep somebody alive even when you lower the temperature down to 85 degrees. Yes. Wait for a cure. Well, where it's been done successfully with more primitive life forms, what they have to do is take the body temperature down to a very low figure very quickly. Because where the damage is done is when you're running around a few degrees below the freezing point of water. That's right. That's where the water expands and breaks all the cell membranes. Then you're in real trouble. But with some primitive life forms, they've been able to keep it viable by quickly dropping the temperature, say 250 or 300 degrees. They get it really low very fast. And so they're able to bypass that stage where the cell destruction would take place. Well, if you get it really low enough, you don't get the expansion damage that you would at the higher temperatures. But it's only been done for very primitive life forms. If you try something as advanced as a mammal, it doesn't work. You destroy the tissue. You've never killed it. Yeah, I need to watch my language. I'm sorry. A better word would be maybe a hibernation state, just a cooled hibernation state. So it's like, yeah, they go to sleep, and the argument would be, well, while they're sleeping, they're not decaying as rapidly as when they're awake. We know one problem with the cryogenics, cosmic rays, all right? They go into this hibernation state, but they're still being exposed to radiation, which means that they're decaying. So when they are brought back to a state of animation, they're not in as good shape as they were when they went into that state. So in that sense, I'd advise you, if you get stuff in the mail about cryogenics, put it in that little circular cylinder you have there in the kitchen. It's not worth it. It's not going to do anything for you. So, yeah, quickly. Yeah, we did discuss that, and it is discussed as well in the book, The Genesis Question. the argument that people counted years differently long ago, and that explains why the historical records say about 1,000 years apiece. And the Bible speaks about 360-day years. But as we've discussed in this class, the reason why ancient societies counted their years as 360 days instead of 365 and a quarter, and their theological systems, it was essential that each month had the same number of days. So you take 365 and a quarter, you divide by 12, you get 30. But they knew full well that they were missing 5 1/4 days. It's not significant, and by the way, all these ancient societies that spoke about these long lifespans employed astronomers to measure the length of the year because it was important as to figure out the time to plant their crops. And each of these civilizations, even the most ancient of them, knew the length of the year to an accuracy of plus or minus 2 minutes or better. So they knew exactly how long the year was. They just had a different New Year celebration than we do. I mean, you know, January 1, we celebrate the New Year. What they did in those ancient civilizations, say, well, you know, 6 years have gone by, and that means we've got 30 extra days. Let's have a New Year's month. And they'd get rid of all the extra days that way. And then they would wait another 6 years, and they would do it all over again. Yeah, you got the idea. Okay. Okay, another way to test all this stuff, it says, what fascinates me is nobody's done an experiment, say, with dogs or chimps or gorillas, have raised them in an enhanced equivalent of a cosmic ray environment, see what happens. It's not been done as far as I know. But there are experiments that indicate that this is approximately a correct deduction because of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Chernobyl, events like that, and just simple accidents. I mean, the first of these were different physicists involved in the Manhattan Project that got a little bit too exposed to plutonium and uranium, and that's when they first began to realize, gee, it's not just the heat and the blast. Radiation can be a real problem. But the other way to do it is the positive way. Let's see if we can protect either human beings or advanced animals from radiation, see what happens. But as I mentioned, you've got to really be careful about this because you've got radiation in the Earth's crust. You've got cosmic radiation. And the way to avoid the cosmic radiation is to go a few hundred feet underground. Cosmic rays aren't able to penetrate that efficiently through all that material. So you get quite a bit of protection from cosmic rays. Some of the really energetic stuff gets through, but most of it you're able to block out. But the problem is when you go that far underground, you actually expose yourself to more radiation from uranium and thorium decaying in the Earth's crust. Now, the only way I know of to get around that is to have some human beings or advanced animals live in a cavity that's well protected from Earth material that would contain radiometric elements. That's why I was suggesting a salt deposit. If you've got a deposit of salt that's, say, 2,000 feet thick, there isn't going to be very much uranium and thorium in that salt. And it's thick enough, it'll protect you from the granite that would have that kind of material in it. However, I'm not aware of any salt deposit that would work. It's possible that some salt deposits like that do exist, where you could drill down through the earth into the salt deposit. Animals live there for a while and see how well they do. And what you'd really like to do is to have some radiation detectors around them to really guarantee that they're living in an environment that's a lot less radiation enhanced. Now then, if you're using human subjects, what you should be able to observe is that instead of people dying at 70 or 80 years, they're making it to 100, 110, up to 120. You should see them approach the apoptosis limit of 120 years in that kind of experiment. Again, I don't know of any experiment like that's been done. In fact, I'm quite confident it hasn't been done. And it hasn't even been done for advanced animals. That's another way to test it. You know, take dogs or chimps or gorillas and see if you can get them to the apoptosis limit. By the way, one of the things that makes it less attractive is that typically with advanced animals, their apoptosis limit is set below the radiation limit, well below the radiation limit. So the experiment's worthless. For example, if you were doing cheetahs, cheetahs live an average of 8 or 9 years. And that's not enough time to really have the radiation kick in. What you really want to do is work with a species like elephants or humans. Gorillas might work because they live quite a long time too, but not as long as we do. You really want a long-lived species that's got an apoptosis significantly beyond their average lifespan. And I don't, again, not a biologist. We have biologists here. Maybe they can tell us. It's possible if the human species is really the only candidate you can work with. Because you know, we're that species where we have an apoptosis of 120 years, but an average lifespan limited by radiation to somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 or 90 years. And that gives you a good 30-year difference. So you could run the experiment. Now, this may all be a moot point because what group of human beings is going to volunteer for such an experiment? I mean, is there anybody here in the class who'd be willing to live their entire lifespan inside a little cavity, inside a salt deposit, thousands of feet below the surface of the earth, and then have your children? We got two volunteers right here. Great. Well, that's a factor, too. I mean, you have a couple of dozen people living in a cavity inside a salt deposit, thousands of feet below the ground. Psychologically, they may do themselves in even before you get to 50 or 60 years. I mean, maybe even 5 years they might. Yeah, 5 years will seem like a 900 years in that kind of environment. So the fact that you're probably not going to get any volunteers for such an experiment means it may never be done. And using advanced animals, you might not get enough of a difference between the apoptosis and the radiation-limiting time to really do an appropriate experiment. So in that sense, we're not going to be able to do the positive test. My guess is there will be future events that will allow us to do the negative test. Maybe Cuba is the best place to look. They've got some reactors there that are really on the edge of failing. So, you know, if they have another accident down there, then we could, you know, see what impact that has. But Chernobyl, Nagasaki, and Hiroshima, plus some of the accidents that have happened to physicists, really may qualify as enough of a test to say, you know, we're on the right track here. Cosmic radiation really does significantly limit lifespan. And given that the cosmic radiation went up by a factor of 10 or more with a Vela supernova, that could easily be the explanation for lifespans going from 900-plus years down to a maximum 120. Yes.
Parents or turtles who live 90 years, something,
getting there, apoptosis is kind of an emerging field of study. So I don't know whether the apoptosis of parrots has been measured yet. So, yes. Well, the apoptosis, at least for human beings, has been measured.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, how can you measure something when you're in a radiation-rich environment, and you're saying, well, even without this radiation, cells stop reproducing at a certain point? How do we know that? Because any and all tests can be done.
Richard's going to answer your question for you. All right.
No, I'm waiting for a while to explain
they are easily separated. Richard's going to tell you. Okay, well, yeah, but I mean, what Richard's referring to is you can alter things chemically so that the apoptosis is shut down, so the apoptosis isn't working, and you can induce apoptosis, and the radiation doesn't make any difference. So what I'm suggesting here in the text, the Vela supernova exploded, and that Vela supernova by itself would make it impossible for human beings to live beyond 120 years. And then what God did was he reprogrammed her apoptosis. So he took it down from, say, 1,000 years down to 120 years. Why did he do that? Because the radiation from the Vela supernova, if you didn't reprogram the apoptosis, would actually yield us shorter lifespans than the 120. Because apoptosis is a powerful check against, you know, certain cancers. Yes.
Okay. See if this is the question. Does apoptosis happen all at once? You walk along this line and all of a sudden every cell in your body decides to die? Or is
no.
it a gradual thing? If it's a gradual thing, then you can monitor statistically the gradual evolution of the apoptosis and figure out the limit, which would be the limit of the apoptosis. If it were a one-time event that never happened because radiation fell first, then you'd never get the measure when that one-time event would occur. But I think that it's probably the trending kind of thing, the measure of trend is too long.
Right. And after a while, you know it's going to catch up with you and do you in. Yes.
The main problem is the way the cells reproduce. When normal somatic cells reproduce, they reproduce their DNA, but they don't reproduce. Every time the DNA gets reproduced, it gets shorter. And this is the reason why cells can only reproduce through so many cycles, and then they can't reproduce anymore. And then at that point, they die.
But couldn't we say that maybe that happens because of the influence of radiation?
No. No, the cells are actually programmed to guarantee that they only go so many times, which is actually good for us. If they weren't programmed and something happened bad to a cell.
What's the interaction between radiation and the program? We don't know that.
Well, what I'm saying is that the only interaction is that God intervened supernaturally and gave us a different apoptosis after the Vela supernova. The radiation has nothing to do with the clock that's set. After all, some animals have an apoptosis far below the radiation limit.
Right, but what I'm saying is, how can you say that it's not connected since we can't isolate it, we can't even imagine what it's like to be in an environment without the radiation, because we can't go to that salt deposit that you're talking about and see what it's like.
Okay, what the evolutionists would claim, Kathy, is that take away the radiation, and the species will evolve a longer apoptosis.
That's an assumption.
That's an assumption. Well, there is a way you can test that assumption, okay? Given that the Bible's comment about shortening lifespans is true in Genesis chapter 11, it's far too fast to explain through natural biological evolution. Orders of magnitude too rapid. Given how small a human population was and given the fact this took place only over 1,000 years.
My problem is that I see a connection, given that point, then I see a connection between this increased bombardment and the rapid change in the apoptosis. Is that it would be really easy for me, if I were an evolutionary biologist, it would be really easy for me to conclude that the apoptosis is changing because the radiation bath is changing and that the response is rapid because the bombardment. I'm just, like I say, I'm coming at it as if I were a complete skeptic and I were assuming that you're fitting your conclusions to match what's written in the Bible. And that has to do with John Traeger's question that you never really answered, or at least I didn't understand the answer to that, is that you were saying that this exponential curve you get, you know, that it goes down gradually. First, the people are living 900 and then 500 and then whatever. And you said that fits the curve you'd expect from a zealous supernova cosmic bombardment. But then you said, when he asked you, that there's no experimental way to confirm that you have this exponential change. So do we or do we not? Is that a theoretical assumption that a bombardment will bring an exponential curve?
Okay. What we do know is that it takes some time for the cosmic radiation to rebuild to maximum intensity. So that part fits. What we don't have any data on is that, you know, looking at what the Bible says here, we would be concluding that God step-by-step brought down the apoptosis maximum throughout this whole period. So it would be God supernaturally intervening to reprogram the cell death from, say, a 1,000-year maximum down to 900, 800, 700, 600, 500, 400, 300, etc. Now, the evolutionist has got to step in and say that all happened through mutations and natural selection. But it's not going to fly because you're making it happen far too fast. And you're working with a population that's far too small. You know, the human population no way can react to that kind of an event. And that's because of how you're having to change the genes. This is complex chemistry you're having to introduce step by step. Okay.
Seems like you ought to be able to do one kind of experiment, just go down into salt mines and grow cell cultures.
Yes. Hasn't been done. Yeah, none of these things have been done. So that could be done. But what you really want to do, Don, is you want to work with a species where you've got a significant difference between the limit imposed by apoptosis and the limit imposed by radiation. If there is no difference, the experiment's a waste of time. And for most species on the planet, that's the situation. They're dying a lot faster than what the, you know, as I said, you know, take jaguars or cheetahs as an example. They're dying due to apoptosis far more rapidly than what radiation would limit them to. So doing an experiment with them isn't going to give you anything. Human beings may be your only option, in which case you've got problems finding volunteers. If you can find such a deposit, I mean, I've asked my geophysicist friends, is there any kind of deposit that you could find in the crust of the Earth where you could really do this experiment? And they all say, oh, I think so, but I can't name you one. So that question needs to be addressed, too. Are we even going to find a place? Yes.
Is it possible that all God's given me to have done would be to somehow have Noah's ark genome in the ark affected by radiation, and then that would have been passed down to his son and then to all of his descendants? I'm trying to think of a way where God would have to be continually intervening miraculously in order for explanation.
Well, that would work if you see a sudden jump from 900 years down to 120. That's not what we see in the text. It seems to gradually go down. And, you know, the natural process of mutation and natural selection isn't going to work to make things happen that fast. It's far too extreme, given what you got to do. Okay. Hey, what I want to get to is something kind of positive in all of this. All right? Our time is up. Well, let me zing this one in our remaining minute or two here. The higher the altitude you live at, the more cosmic radiation you get exposed to. The lower the elevation you live at, the more radiation you get exposed to from the decay of materials in the Earth's crust. And if you live underground, it's even worse. Okay, what we discover is that you get a minimum of radiation exposure that runs from sea level to a couple of thousand feet above sea level. That's where you get exposed to the least amount of radiation. Now, you look at a globe. In terms of how much land area there is that meets that description, a lot. And so, you know, going back to the big perspective of God trying to design an ideal environment for human beings, he set up the planet in such a way that billions of us can live relatively close to sea level. We don't have to live below sea level. We don't have to live up high in the peaks. And so we all get to enjoy this radiation minimum. So, pardon me? Well, that's true. Living in Colorado Springs, your lifespan is going to be shortened by a few months.
Those of us
in Colorado, I hope that the California continue to believe that. So, well, as some Coloradans have said, you know, living a couple of months less is worth it because look at all the extra skiing I get in. So, the quality of life aspect. So, and living in Moscow with all those granite buildings could be a problem. So, because then you're exposing yourself to a little more radiation. But the bottom line is this. God has really worked out our planet at this time in history in such a way that we really do have the best possible situation. Yeah, things aren't such that we're all having to live at elevations above Colorado Springs. And it's not like we all have to live underground and get exposed to radiation that way. We get to live in these coastal plains and other places where we really do experience the minimum radiation and can live a long time. But you know what? A month over 70 years is not that much. That's nothing compared to the risk of smoking. That takes 9 years off your life if you smoke all your life. So, hey, what's one month compared to that? But, for example, airline pilots live a little bit less than the rest of us because they're up there at 30,000 feet. And the cosmic radiation there is a whole lot more intense than it is in Colorado Springs. But even then, it only knocks off 3 months. It's not a long time. Well, I mean, the difference between sea level and 1,000 or 2,000 feet isn't that great. When the atmosphere gets thinned out, then it makes a difference because, you know, the thicker atmosphere does absorb some of the cosmic radiation. And so, yeah, if you're at the top of Mount Whitney, you get considerably more exposed. So, yes.
What's the aim of those that go into mines for therapeutic reasons?
Do people go into mines for therapeutic reasons? I didn't even know that. Is this some kind of new cult that's running around now or... So, no, this is new to me. Is there some kind of religious movement where people want to live down in mines?
Nope.
Maybe that's going to send even more people to Colorado. I don't know. Okay, so they go underground to get exposed to some radon. They think that's got some health benefits. They need to take a physics course. Radon's not nice. So, boy, this is a new one on me. Mind therapy. I thought he was talking about M-I-N-D. He's talking about M-I-N-E. All right, time to close. Father in heaven, we thank you for this time we've had looking at this question that skeptics raise about the validity of the Bible and why these long lifespans are even possible and why God would react this way. And Lord, thank you for all that you revealed in your word. Thank you for shortening our lifespan. Thank you for showing us the benefit of a briefer lifespans. And thank you for allowing us to be alive in a day when we can see hard scientific evidence that demonstrates that there is at least the possibility, scientific possibility, what you say is true. That we've removed the point of ridicule. Help us to use this in an effective way to demonstrate to people that you have communicated truthfully and perfectly through the Holy Bible. And Lord, may that cause many to really look at its moral message, its salvation message, that your light may penetrate hearts and bring them into your kingdom and prepare them for a new creation where we will never again get exposed to life-threatening radiation, where it will be safe to live a long time. In Jesus' name, amen.